Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's formal recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, announced today, and his plan to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv. The former spokesman for Shimon Peres, Gideon Levy, and Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz, joins us from Tel Aviv to discuss Trump's gift to Netanyahu that leaves the U.S. totally isolated as the only country in the world to have an embassy in Jerusalem. We'll assess the likely impact of Trump's announcement on the Palestinian territories and in the neighboring countries, and the extent to which it dims the hope for any future two-state solution, a prospect that already appears to be dead in the water. We will also examine the similarities between Trump and Netanyahu, in as much as both are pursuing aggressive right-wing policies, while judicial inquiries close in on them and threaten their political futures. Then we'll get an analysis of whether the rush to get something passed by the Republicans so that they will not have to run next year as the do-nothing Congress will result in a worse backlash once their constituents know what is in their so-called tax reform bill and how much it will hurt average Americans. Paul Waldman, who writes for The Washington Post's Plumline and is a contributing editor to The American Prospect, where he has an article, How Republicans Are Digging Their Own Grave for 2018, and another at The Week, Republicans' Remarkable Self-Deception on Tax Cuts, joins us to discuss the possibility that the bill will die in conference as many members from blue states begin to realize how much their vote for the bill will amount to political suicide. Then finally, we will speak with the former speechwriter for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Mark Seddon, a professor of international relations at Columbia University, about his article at The Guardian, Have We Got Just 3 Months to Avert a U.S. Attack on North Korea? He joins us to discuss John Bolton's recent trip to the UK House of Commons, where the former U.S. ambassador to the UN relayed a message from the Trump White House that the CIA head had told Trump that he had a 3-month window to strike North Korea before they had the capability to hit Washington with a nuclear-tipped ICBM. And joining us now from Tel Aviv, Israel, is Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and Gideon writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza for the last 25 years, and his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much.
And today, Donald Trump did what people feared he would do, and he announced that the U.S. was going to move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, making the United States the only country in the world that would have an embassy in Jerusalem. And the assumption here is that this would signal basically an end to the two-state solution, an end to any possibility of a Palestinian state, because the end game, if you will, of a deal would be a deal over Jerusalem, and this is preempting that possibility. So do you see it in as dire terms as the rest of the world appears to see it?
Not exactly, because I think the end of the two-state solution happened already a few years ago. This will maybe symbol it, but it happened long before. I don't tend to think that it is such a dramatic change right now. It's more declarative, and I think that in a few weeks we will forget about it. It is less meaningful than it seems, because by the end of the day we are dealing mainly with rhetoric and quite empty rhetoric.
Well, but in the meantime, will there be violence? There's talk of a new intifada. Clearly this impacts Jordan, which is majority Palestinians. So are you concerned about reactions in the Palestinian and the Arab world at large, or is that just a momentary temper tantrum?
It's very hard to foresee. You see, the first intifada broke because of a car accident, so you never know. But as it seems now, there will be some violence, but very limited. I don't see the energy for another uprising, for another intifada.
And in terms of King Abdullah in Jordan, he's obviously worried. He's a pretty tenuous situation there. Is there any indications? I mean, the Jordanians have always had a control, if you will, over access to the third holiest shrine of Islam. And we've seen incidents in the past where it doesn't, as you point out, one intifada started by a car accident. It doesn't take much to meddle with the Temple Mount to rile up the Islamic world, does it not?
Right, but it really depends on what will be, because practically nothing changes now. The influence of Jordan in Jerusalem will remain as it was. By the end of the day, we are speaking about the reality of an Israeli occupation which lasts now for 50 years. And this is what matters much more than another speech.
Well, I don't know whether you noticed an opinion piece in the New York Times about a week ago by former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, but he said that Israel finds its very future identity and security severely threatened by the whims and illusions of the ultranational government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, a lot of Americans feel that they are subject to the whims of Donald Trump, as indeed in the case that we're talking about, moving the embassy for no apparent reason. So what's your sense of whether, what kind of a deal is there between Netanyahu and Trump? Is Trump doing Netanyahu's bidding? Because we just learned recently from the special prosecutor's indictment of General Flynn, the short-lived national security advisor, that Jared Kushner lobbied Flynn to go and talk to the Russian ambassador to see if they could do something about Obama's expected vote on the Security Council to condemn settlements, which eventually ended in a U.S. abstention. It was pretty clear from what was revealed in those court documents that Jared Kushner was doing Netanyahu's bidding. So there seems to be some kind of relationship, whether Jared Kushner is the go-between between his father-in-law and Netanyahu. What's your understanding of that relationship, and what similarities do you see between Netanyahu and Trump, given what Ehud Barak wrote about recently in the New York Times?
Oh, there are so many similarities, and above all, they are both in troubles. Both Netanyahu and Trump are in troubles now. Both face investigations. And both believe also, in many ways, believe in the same values. And I'm not sure that for both of them, the future of their own country is their main concern or the first concern. No doubt that Trump gave Netanyahu a present today, and the present in times that Netanyahu is getting more and more complicated in the investigations. Pay even the attention to the small fact that Donald Trump did it at 8 o'clock local time Israel, which is the Israeli prime time on TV. Nothing is by chance here. He really gave him a present, God knows why and God knows what for. It will not be for the benefit neither for Israel nor for peace.
Well, Barak mentioned in his recent article in the New York Times that Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party recently introduced legislation that would explicitly forbid the police from recommending indictments at the end of high-profile investigations. To clear up any questions about his intentions, the law would apply even to inquiries that are already open, like the one into the Prime Minister's dealings. That certainly sounds like a mirror of what's being speculated over here, is that Donald Trump wants to shut down Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the last elections, and he may well do that at the end of the year. So, again, there's a similarity there, but the fact that the Likud party's already introduced that legislation, where does it stand? I mean, that's a get-out-of-jail-free pass, isn't it?
No, not really, because it's all about publishing the recommendation of the police. This does not mean that it's just postponing the public echo, not much more than this. And for Netanyahu, it's vital because he wanted to gain more time in office. In any case, this was postponed now, and I'm not sure that this will ever will be legislated after there was quite a big protest in Israel against it.
And what exactly has he done or alleged to have done?
Netanyahu.
Yes.
He got gifts for hundreds and thousands of dollars from some friends in terms of cigars and champagnes. He might be involved in one or two cases of bribery or suspicions to bribery with a publisher of the biggest Israeli newspaper who offered him a deal. And in the background, there is still the story of the submarine deal with Germany, which all his surrounding is involved, but he claims not to know anything, but this is still to be investigated.
And again, I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. So is that to say that the judiciary in Israel is strong and independent? I mean, in this country, the Democrats are completely out of power and the Republicans don't even include them in any negotiations anymore, like with the tax bill. They just ignored them totally. So you have the total control by a far right-wing Republican Party now, which has been taken over by its right wing, as it appears that has also happened in Israel. And the only people that are sort of fighting back, if you will, ironically, what Stephen Bannon and the alt-right people over here call the deep state. So, again, I'm bringing up kind of analogies or similarities. But is there a similarity there between the fact that the opposition to Netanyahu politically is weak, but the judiciary is not necessarily weak?
No, there is one basic difference between Israel and the United States that in Israel, the legal system, the judges are nominated and not elected, while in your country they are elected, so they depend more on politicians. In Israel, it seems more independent, but Netanyahu and his party are doing in the recent years all possible effort to weaken the legal system, and they had some success. I wouldn't call it strong and independent. They didn't win yet, but there are quite serious cracks. And they are relatively weak, relatively strong and relatively independent, but I wouldn't take it for granted. There are so many efforts to weaken them. And you see the behavior of the legal system. Many investigations take much too much time than they should, and only public pressure moves some investigations. The media is pushing hard for some investigations, and the legal system has no other choice but to follow those pressures. But this is not a strong and independent system, by all means not.
So in terms of U.S. influence, you know, we have, of course, AIPAC here in Washington is considered a pretty powerful organization. But it does seem in terms of what Donald Trump is, and of course he made this promise in a speech he gave to AIPAC of moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And he's now today saying he's fulfilling that promise. But it seems to me that in many ways this is more going to resonate with the so-called Christian Zionists in this country, the religious right that have this peculiar support for Israel based on the idea that Israel will trigger Armageddon. And that in itself strikes me as some kind of spiritual pornography. But nevertheless, that seems to be the ties there. But with Netanyahu making this deal with the ultra-Orthodox parties that essentially makes American Jews, particularly Reform and Conservative Jews, second-class citizens in terms of access to the prayer space at the Western Wall, for example. Do you think that's going to affect support for Israel, or at least support for this right-wing government from America?
First of all, it didn't move the embassy. It will take some months and maybe some years, and maybe it will never happen. Remember, he just declared that in the same time he signed the bill to postpone it for another 6 months. And time will show if Donald Trump will really move the embassy. And by the end of the day, in my view, moving the embassy to Jerusalem has a very, very limited practical meaning. It's more declarative, and it's time to show if this will happen at all. As for the support of the Christian Zionists and others, I don't call those circles friends of Israel. They are the biggest enemies of Israel because they teach Israel that it can go wild, it can do whatever it wants, and it will get blind and automatic support. This is not friendship.
And in terms of Netanyahu's capitulation to the Orthodox parties on religious issues, will that affect Israel's relationship with American Jews?
Yes, it did already by now. It did already, and there is quite a growing gap between the Israeli government and the Jewish establishment in the United States. Netanyahu did so because he has the substitute, and the substitute is, as you rightly mentioned, the Christian Zionists.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Gideon Levy. I guess in closing, you're not that alarmed by what's happened, and you don't think necessarily it's that significant, but we don't know what kind of reactions they're going to be in the so-called Arab street and their closer to you in the Palestinian territories.
Right. I'm very alarmed, but not necessarily from this speech. I'm very alarmed from the fact that there is no one here to put an end to the occupation.
Well, Gideon Levy, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of whether the rush to get something passed by the Republicans so that they will not have to run next year as a do-nothing Congress will result in a worse backlash once their constituents know what is in their so-called tax reform bill and how much it will hurt average Americans. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paul Waldman, who's a contributing editor for The American Prospect and an author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And he has an article at The American Prospect, How Republicans Are Digging Their Own Grave for 2018, and another article, Republicans' Remarkable Self-Deception on Tax Cuts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Waldman.
Thank you.
So here in California, and we are being punished, which seems to be sort of spiteful. It's so obvious that the successful blue states like California and New York, who contribute more to the red states in terms of dollars than they get back from the federal government, are being punished in a petty way by losing the ability to deduct state and local taxes. In other words, they take better care of their citizens, and now they're getting punished for them. What other motive could you detect there apart from political spite?
Well, for that provision, it's hard to detect anything other than that. Stephen Moore, who's one of the Republican Party's most influential advisors on tax matters, came out and said that the other day, that he said it was death to Democrats, a whole bunch of different provisions that are just meant to kind of screw over Democrats and people who live in Democratic states. And, of course, there are also a lot of Republicans who live in states that are controlled by Democrats, too. So they're going to suffer as well. It is quite remarkable that it looks like a lot of the provisions in this tax bill are really motivated by that kind of spite. Things like there's an attack on universities. Big university endowments are now going to have to pay a tax. There was a provision in the House bill that might or might not survive that makes it so that graduate students who get tuition waivers will have to pay taxes on those waivers as if it was income. And that can be, $50,000, which is never money that they actually see. It's just that they don't have to pay tuition because they're working as teachers and research assistants, that they'd have to, come up with $10,000 to pay the government, which would make it impossible for a lot of people to complete their PhDs. Now, as I said, that might not survive in the eventual bill because it was in the House bill but not the Senate bill. But there's a whole bunch of things like that that really just seemed aimed at hurting people that Republicans don't like.
Well, what don't they like about educated people? I mean, one of the other provisions is you can no longer deduct interest on student debt.
I think through the process, they were kind of casting about for ways to pay for the centerpiece of the bill, which is the cut in corporate tax rates. They passed a budget that said that the entire cost had to be kept under $1.5 trillion. And they had this thing that they really wanted to do, which was to cut the corporate rate radically from 35% down to 20%, and also a bunch of other cuts that primarily benefit the wealthy as well. And so they had to come up with some tax increases that would pay for this all. So part of it was the big things like eliminating the personal exemptions and things like that. But also they're kind of casting about for a whole bunch of little provisions that they can use to help defray the cost of the corporate cuts. And so things like student loan interest just fell into that because they were, they're kind of grabbing things left and right that they think will enable them to pay for it all.
So in terms of your article, Paul Waldman, at the American Prospect, how Republicans are digging their own grave for 2018, does that mean, for example, here in California, where the citizens are going to really be punished by this so-called tax reform, and it's going to hurt? I think it's going to raise their taxes by 20% to 25%, and that definitely will get people's attention. There are, I think, 11 of the 14 Republican Congress people in California voted for this bill. Are they going to get punished? I mean, that's almost enough to flip the House, isn't it?
Yeah, and some of them are in districts where they're definitely vulnerable. And there's an assumption that all Republicans seem to share right now, which is that if they don't pass this tax cut bill, then they're dead politically, that their base will abandon them, that they will have shown that they can't do anything even when they have all the levers of power in their possession, and that will just be political disaster. And so what's important is that they pass something. And obviously they have, they genuinely want to cut taxes, but they also feel like it is to not do it is political suicide. The problem is, though, that there's an assumption there, which is that, passing something is better than passing nothing. And if you look at what's happening right now, you see that passing this bill in particular may be worse than passing nothing. It's one of the least popular major pieces of legislation in history. If you look at polls, you find that approval of this bill is around 28-29% or so. And even if the Republican base would be mad if they accomplish nothing and might, consider staying home on Election Day in 2018, what really matters in midterm elections is which side is angrier. And right now, Democrats are extremely angry and riled up. And this tax bill is only getting them angrier and more riled up. you know, if they had done the kind of tax reform that, or the kind of tax cuts, shouldn't even say reform, that Republicans have done in the past, it might not have made people as angry. Because if you think of things like the Bush tax cuts, well, how were those constructed? What they did is they gave a big tax cut to the wealthy, and then they sprinkled some small tax cuts on everyone else. And so everybody got something, and nobody was really hurt. In this case, however, there are a lot of real, genuine losers in this tax bill, people who will see their taxes go up substantially. And so they are creating a lot of people who lose out and who are going to be mad, and that is only going to rile up the Democratic base more for 2018. So I think that they're doing themselves more damage than they would have if they had passed nothing or passed a kind of a simple tax cut the way they used to do.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Waldman, who's a contributing editor for The American Prospect and the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. He has an article at The American Prospect, How Republicans Are Digging Their Own Grave for 2018, and The Republicans' Remarkable Self-Deception on Tax Cuts. Well, speaking of riling up Democrats, I personally am riled up by the idea that because I live in a successful state like California that takes better care of its citizens than they do in Alabama, the idea that they're going to elect a child molester in Alabama and the people that are going to elect him are all these good Christians down there, the idea that I'm subsidizing these people who I think are about to insult the very nature of American democracy is pretty galling.
This is a constant question we have about which states are sort of takers and which states contribute more. And it is ironic that the states where this kind of anti-government feeling is the most intense are often the ones that get the most from the federal government and give the least. And so you find in places like California, where people are perfectly happy to have government solve problems, they're the ones that are contributing the most. And then you have a lot of conservative states, particularly in the South, but also in the Midwest, where the government is spending a lot of money, the federal government, and getting relatively little in taxes from those citizens, and yet they are the ones who complain the loudest about government intrusion on their lives.
Well, what kind of, I mean, I guess we're not talking about secession or anything like that, but is there any way that the Democrats can fight back? Obviously, by taking back the House in 2018 and some heavier lift to take back the Senate, what is it, 25 Democratic seats have to be defended compared to 9 Republican seats in the Senate?
Right.
So they're already at a kind of numerical disadvantage there. Are there any other options short of the ballot box?
Well, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that it's possible with political organizing, if it gets intense enough, to even frighten people who might not be inclined toward the kind of things you're persuading them to do. I mean, we saw that with the attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. You know, there was a huge amount of organizing, and it really spooked a lot of the Republicans. And in the end, you know, it came down to one vote, but it was enough to kill that bill. And so, you know, I think that you have to that kind of political organizing, if it reaches enough of a volume, and you begin to make the members of Congress afraid. You know, even Republicans who might not be inclined to the thing you're trying to convince them to do or not to do, if you make them afraid enough, then, you know, then that works. And so obviously, the biggest thing is electing people who are more inclined toward your views and making sure that you know, register as many of your of like-minded people and get as many of them out to vote as possible. But between elections, organizing does work. It works best on that large scale. But, you know, politicians are all creatures of self-interest. And if you can convince them that they're going to be in trouble if they don't do what you want, then often they will change their minds.
Right, but what they're doing, though, is they're satisfying their donors and trying to con their voters. That's the game they're playing. That's why they rushed it through. That's why they didn't let the Democrats even look at anything. And that's why, at the last minute, they were writing all kinds of sweeteners into the margins. And now that they're negotiating amongst themselves, the House and the Senate Republicans, still keeping the Democrats as much in the dark and out of the loop as they can, this whole process is about hiding what they're doing from the American people. So then it's a question of our learning curve as citizens. How much are we going to learn about how bad this is before they pass it?
Yeah, and that's a, you know, it's a difficult thing because the default position of the American voter is not to know very much. You know, and you can look at that and say it's because they're just ignorant, or you can say it's because they have a lot of other things on their minds and they're not, you know, the average person is not going to spend hours pouring through an analysis of the latest version of the tax bill. But one of the things that we've seen with this is that people seem to get it. If you look at polls, you know, people may not be able to list off all the different provisions, but the vast majority of the public says that this tax bill benefits the rich over the middle class. It's not very popular. And I think Republicans often assume that any tax cut is obviously going to be popular because, hey, you know, you're just giving out candy. But in this case, they're giving out candy to some people and taking away from other people, and the public seems to have gotten that. It obviously helps that it's for many people kind of the default assumption that if Republicans have a tax plan, it's going to benefit the wealthy, and that's a correct assumption. But, you know, I think that Democrats can look at the state of public opinion and at least say that they've done a pretty good job of persuading people and making them understand what's in this bill.
But the key, surely, Paul Walden, would be that if the 11 Republicans here in the state of California, congressmen, that voted for this bill, if their constituents woke up to what's actually in the bill and raised hell and booted these guys out, that would be enough to change the House. So then is it going to happen, one? And two, if it does happen, would that mean that those 11 congresspeople will not vote? Because it's not a foregone conclusion that this bill is going to be signed into law. A lot of bills die in conference. Or as Donald Trump called it the other day, the mixture. He didn't even know what the House and Senate conference is. And I'm sure he doesn't even know that they have to take another vote on both in the House and the Senate on an identical bill. He called it the mixture. But let's start with that. It's true, isn't it, that a lot of bills have died during conference?
Sure. And, you know, they have a tough job to do because there are some substantial differences between the House version and the Senate version. You know, for instance, Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, who's often a moderate, said that she got promises from Mitch McConnell and from President Trump that if she voted for the bill, there would be a couple of other bills that would be passed to help stabilize the insurance markets. But then she voted yes. On the basis of those promises. And then the next day, Paul Ryan said, well, I never promised her anything like that. And so, you know, you could see a lot of things like that happening where one side has, one house has something that they want in there, and the other house has something that they don't want in there, and they can't come to an agreement that will satisfy both of them. And so it is not going to be easy for them to arrive at a compromise bill that would satisfy everybody. But there is one other possibility, which is kind of a fail-safe if they can't get a compromise, which is that the House could just vote on what the Senate already passed. And you could see a scenario where talks break down in the conference committee, and Paul Ryan comes to the House, the House Republicans, and says, look, this is our last chance. This thing is about to die. If we just vote on the Senate bill and pass it, it may not be everything we want, but it'll be a tax cut, and then President Trump can just sign it. And they may end up doing that. That is something that has happened before. People may recall that's what happened with the Affordable Care Act. After Ted Kennedy died and Scott Brown was elected to the Senate in Massachusetts, and the Democrats lost their 60-vote supermajority in the Senate, what happened was the Senate had already passed a bill, and even though it wasn't perfect and people in the House weren't all that happy with it, the House just went ahead and passed the Senate's bill, and that's what you know, what put the Affordable Care Act into law. So that could happen. But it's not going to be easy for them to work out an agreement because, you know, there are some substantial differences between the two versions, and people on both sides, in some cases it's conservatives, in some cases it's moderates, who don't want what the other house passed.
Well, if that were to happen, just in closing, the Senate bill has the attack on the Affordable Care Act. I don't believe the House has that one. And conversely, the punishing the postgrads and bankrupting all the PhD students in this country and quadrupling their taxes, that's in the House bill but not in the Senate bill. So
are heinous things in both bills.
I see.
but a slightly different set of heinous things.
I see.
Each one.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Paul Waldman. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Waldman, who's a contributing editor for The American Prospect and the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. He has an article at The American Prospect, How Republicans Are Digging Their Own Grave for 2018, and another article, Republicans' Remarkable Self-Deception on Tax Cuts. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with the former speechwriter for the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, about his article, Have We Got Just 3 Months to Avert a U.S. Attack on North Korea?
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer.
Me say the war not the answer.
Politician and them bobo niacin, yeah. War is not the answer. I think we know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer. Me tell the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer. I think we know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from the UK is Mark Seddon, a professor of international relations at Columbia University and a former speechwriter for the then UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He also worked as a UN correspondent and New York bureau chief for Al Jazeera English TV. And he has an article at The Guardian, Have We Got Just 3 Months to Avert a U.S. Attack on North Korea? Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Seddon.
Thank you.
And an extraordinary communique came from the State Department today pointing out that the UN United Nations envoy Jeffrey Feltman, who's a former high-level U.S. State Department official who was going to North Korea on behalf of the UN, the State Department went out of its way to say that he is not carrying any message. They're aware of his travels. And I want to make this clear, the State Department spokesman said, that there's no kind of message from the U.S. government that he's carrying. So that seems a bit strange to be almost proud of the fact that we're not communicating with these people.
Well, I mean, I'm not privy to what communications there may or may not be. I mean, clearly there have been backdoor discussions in recent times. We're fairly sure that Secretary of State Tillerson has had backdoor discussions with the North Koreans, and that those discussions we hear didn't really reach any good conclusion. I mean, Jeffrey Feltman is going on behalf of the United Nations. I imagine he's taking some messages from the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres. But you know, the United Nations, as you will have seen, has said this is possibly one of the most high-level visits there have been by a UN official in many years. But of course, it comes at a time of really heightened tensions, and at a time when I suspect some people will be saying, "Well, where is everybody else?" The events seem to be taking a turn of their own, and the world seems to be looking on as two leaders are engaged in a kind of game of chicken.
Well, Donald Trump's actions on moving the U.S. Embassy or announcing the movement of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, which has been met with universal condemnation and alarm, appears to be an act that he's doing simply because he can do it. There doesn't seem to be any sense to it, certainly no gain to it. And if that's extended to his attitude with North Korea, then we could really be in trouble. I think there's a certain amount of leverage, if you will, assumed in the madman theory that goes back to Richard Nixon warning the North Vietnamese that he was sort of crazy and would bomb the hell out of them. But I don't think that works with Kim Jong-un, does it? I mean, haven't the North Koreans been preparing for the last 50 years for an American attack? Isn't that what they live and breathe every day?
Well, I've been there several times, and I've also been to South Korea and China and what have you. My experiences in North Korea is very much as you say, that essentially, yes, there's a siege mentality. As you know, at the end of the Korean War, there was no peace agreement. There was an armistice agreement. And I think the leadership of the North is still hugely influenced by those events. I mean, don't forget that more ordnance was dropped on Korea during the Korean War than was dropped on Nazi Germany during the Second World War. And that generation still actually persists in the higher reaches of the Korean Workers' Party. You can see seared into this regime is the experience of that, but also of a fairly brutish wish to survive by the regime. This is, as you know, the only kind of hereditary Marxist-Leninist regime that we know of, really. And so, yes, it's predicated on that, and yes, a belief that essentially the United States and other allies, such as Japan, are intent on harm. I mean, of course, that sort of ignores various attempts in the past, where there have been better relations, most notably under the Clinton administration. The North Koreans believe, and we've seen the whole ramping up of both the language, the number of military, the number of ICBM tests, the nuclear tests of the North, and of course the military exercises that have been taking place across the border, of which one is happening right now, a four-day joint operation involving 12,000 military personnel from both the US and South Korea.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Seddon, who is in the UK. He's a professor of international relations at Columbia University and a former speechwriter for the then UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He also worked as a UN correspondent and New York bureau chief for Al Jazeera English TV. And he has an article at The Guardian, "Have We Got Just 3 Months to Avert a US Attack on North Korea?" Well, wouldn't the point therefore be, Mark Seddon, that since the North Koreans have been preparing for this apocalyptic moment when the enemy that they've been told for over 50 years that bombed the hell out of them and during the Korean War will strike at any moment, wouldn't that therefore preclude the possibility of them being caught by surprise, even with these stealth bombers like the F-22 and the B-2 that the U.S. has in this exercise that you just mentioned, but nearby? I mean, it just seems to me that the idea that there's a technical fix to this is reckless and dangerous.
Well, I mean, I think clearly there isn't a technical fix because you can't fix something that's been horrendously broken. And what we mean by that is mass casualties right across the Korean Peninsula, radioactive clouds, no doubt, possibility of other countries becoming involved. I think that the whole world is looking on aghast. I think the United Nations is too at what is going on and really wants to try and get both sides together. Now, of course, the North Koreans have historically wanted to have direct talks with the United States, and in fact, you know, occasionally President Trump intimates, that there may be circumstances one day when he would sit down with Kim Jong-un. But the idea that the North Koreans, I have to think that the biggest danger comes potentially from something happening in error at a time of extremely heightened tensions. We do have this view that I reported on on hearing that former US UN Ambassador John Bolton had said that the CIA had reported to the president that there's a three-month window before the North Koreans actually have the capability to launch an ICBM with a nuclear payload that could possibly hit an American city. So we know that this ramping up is going on, but it's still, I think what clearly must stay the hand of people who might be advising for preemptive action is that the sheer carnage that could result from a North Korean conventional military barrage across the south to Seoul is something that really strikes terror into the South Koreans. Now, of course, I mean, I'm not a military person, so one would assume that the American military are taking a look at the capacity of the North to do that. And if there is any military confrontation, how that could be best militated. But, you know, this is the danger, I think, at the moment comes from something happening by mistake or a smaller incident getting out of hand. And that's got to be the biggest fear.
But we seem to be very cavalier about South Korean casualties. Lindsay Anderson, the senator, has made some rather cavalier remarks about going to war and without thinking about the collateral damage. And his latest statements are that U.S. dependence should be taken out of South Korea, military dependence and diplomatic dependence, and that the U.S. should not send any more dependence into the country. How is that being responded to in South Korea? I mean,
I'm not there, so I can't tell you. I can't give you an answer. But what we do know is that this new South Korean administration began by and was elected really for a variety of reasons, but one of them was really to begin a new process of rapprochement with the North, but has found itself boxed in as tensions have increased. And look, I mean, tensions are being exacerbated by both sides. There's no question of that. It's not it's the North Korean regime and elements of the United States administration who I think do not have a nuanced or deep understanding of North Korea and really do need to learn pretty rapidly. But I think you get the impression that the South wanted to do that, but it feels boxed in. And, of course, it's very concerned. It doesn't want to be in a situation where it upsets its major military ally, the United States. And, of course, we'll be looking at a time of belligerence, that perhaps what options it might have in the future. And of course, there's a wider issue about the increased nuclearization of the whole region. All of this aids those in Japan who want to rip up the post Second World War constitution and develop nuclear weapons. South Korea, nuclear weapons, becoming a nuclear weapons state. And also people do forget as well that the Chinese are not happy with Kim Jong-un at all. I mean, they feel that they have had very, very little leeway with this new regime. I don't believe that Kim Jong-un has even been to Beijing. Certainly you hear that, the very basic sort of links that were there before simply aren't there now. So China feels very angry about what's going on too. It leads to a perfect storm unless things are done pretty rapidly now to defuse it. And one hopes that the visit by UN Assistant Secretary General Jeffrey Feltman helps in that process.
So, Mark Seddon, are you still in touch with your former boss, Ban Ki-moon, former UN?
No, I'm not. And you would, I mean, of course, he's now one of what they call the UN elders. And so he, I'm sure, will be speaking with others such as Kofi Annan and his successor. And I'm sure if that, you know, he felt and they felt that he could do something, he would be involved. It may well be that he is, for all we know. I mean, don't forget that he was one of the architects of the Sunshine Policy with the North, which led to greater rapprochement before. But I'm sure if, you know, anybody looking at this would probably say this has got to be the most serious situation there has been on the Korean Peninsula since the ending of the Korean War in 1953. And with, you know, this race. I mean, of course, I mean, the other thing that is kind of sort of slightly glossed over because people look at the fanaticism of the North is that this is that they have a million conscript army, a million man conscript army, but you know most of the North Korean military is kind of Soviet era hardware is kind of not really up to scratch. It's got fuel shortages. There are claims that it may have perhaps a year's supply of oil. It's sort of hidden away for this situation. But you know, beyond the nuclear program and beyond possibly a chemical weapons program, the North military is pretty dated. So you know, it's not this great invincible power. But at the same time, you have to take a look at it, and you look at Kim Jong Un and his predecessor leaders, and they all took a look themselves at what happened to Saddam Hussein and to Gaddafi in Libya. And they believe that they are safer having a nuclear missiles. But all of this, of course, what they're doing is in complete contravention of UN Security Council resolutions. And this is where the UN has a key role to play.
Well, I understand that Donald Trump consistently and persistently asks his Secretary of Defense, Dash Security Advisor, etc., for options, for military options, that he's frustrated. You know, he knows he's called Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and other names and talked about fire and fury. And he's apparently continually told that the options aren't good. But then, as you mentioned earlier, John Bolton was in London saying that the CIA has told the White House that there's only a three-month window to do something before the North has the capability to strike the U.S. mainland with nuclear warheads on missiles. Why they would do that is another matter, but just assuming that the capability threshold is 3 months away and that has a kind of life of its own, that pressure, the clock is ticking. That seems to be the case, and Pompeo at the CIA is very much a political guy, very ambitious and quite a hawk, and the guy that would replace him at CIA is even worse, Senator Tom Cotton. So we don't have a lot to... I don't know where the restraint is coming from. Do you have any sense that there's anybody restraining Trump?
Well, I'm not there, so it's very difficult. All I can do is kind of like anybody else. I go on what I hear, what I read, but also on my kind of my understanding of what makes the North Korean regime tick and what I think makes people in America tick. And you get the impression, certainly, that Secretary of State Tillerson has been a restraining factor. You also, our understanding, insofar as we have it, of Donald Trump as president is that his mood can change from hour to hour, and that, you know, what may seem a great verity one moment can be completely turned on its head the next. So, you know, there's a degree. I mean, I think what particularly disturbing to anybody who's been looking at this is the sheer puerility of the dealings between Trump on Twitter and also some of the responses by Kim Jong-un. I mean, the people also need to know that the language that is used in North Korea is often very formal, old Korean. It's dated in comparison with the Korean that is spoken south of the border, but it's littered with the sort of guttural expletives. The way they use language about enemies is pretty offensive, but I think even they were unprepared for something that they had never come across before, which is a president who tweets whatever's coming into his mind at any given moment. And I think the social media has been this kind of weird echo chamber. It's exaggerated things. It's increased tensions. But it's been just staggeringly puerile. And the failure of those around Trump to rein him in, the failure of his party is just kind of lamentable in a great democracy such as America. It is absolutely lamentable. I think it's probably a uniform global view. It's very difficult to find anybody out there who thinks any differently, really.
Well, just in closing, China's role, of course, we keep expecting China to get our irons out of the fire, and there's no love lost between Beijing and Pyongyang. And they killed the brother who the Chinese were grooming, and the uncle was also killed. So it's pretty clear that Kim Jong-un fears the Chinese, if he fears anybody at all. The Chinese don't want the U.S. Army on the Yellow River. They don't want the place to collapse. And the U.S. is pressuring them now to cut off oil supplies, which the Chinese worry would precipitate a collapse in the north. So the only option would be for some kind of Chinese military invasion and to remove that regime and put in a more amenable one, because the Chinese are certainly not going to let the South and the Americans take over the North in the event of a collapse.
Yes. So
is there anything to that? I mean, I know I'm not a warmonger, I can guarantee you, but I want to run that scenario by you just in closing.
Well, I mean, at the moment, I mean, given what we know, given what we're hearing, of course, you know, there's in all of this, there's an awful lot of black propaganda that flies around from all sides. But I think where we are right now, if you were in Beijing, if you're one of the old wise men in the Chinese Politburo, you'd be probably thinking about what sort of collapse is worse. A collapse that brought about by turning off the sort of oil pipeline that keeps a sort of drip feed to the North Korean regime, or a collapse after a military conflict, which would be potentially far worse, because you know, this conflict would know no boundaries when it comes to, for instance, radioactive pollution. So, well, one has to think, yes. I mean, career watchers have talked for years of the possibility of some kind of Chinese-inspired coup that would possibly leave Kim Jong-un like Emperor Hirohito in Japan after the Second World War as a sort of titular head of state. But as you were just saying, at least two of the potential candidates for that role have either been executed, i.e. Kim Jong-un's uncle and regent, and subsequently his half-brother, who was assassinated in Malaysia. So, yeah, unless we move to a situation whereby there can be some really meaningful UN-Chinese brokered talks that open the way for serious talks between the Trump administration and North Korea, those are clearly options that may happen. I mean, altogether, right now we are staring into the abyss, and I think the world is waking up to this.
Well, Mark Seddon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Seddon, who's a professor of international relations at Columbia University and a former speechwriter for the then UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He also worked as a UN correspondent and New York bureau chief for Al Jazeera English TV. And he has an article at The Guardian, "Have We Got Just 3 Months to Avert a US Attack on North Korea?" And he joined us from the UK. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.